In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about the now ongoing for more than a year conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, or at least some segments of the Palestinian movement. Our guest for the program is Mark Perry. He has been with us before on the show fairly recently, in fact. We talked with him about the issue of military tribunals for people who are suspects of terrorism and concerns that a number of people have raised about civil liberties and the war against terrorism. And at that time, also, we said, well, probably it would be a good idea to talk a little bit about the Middle East, and we just didn't get the opportunity. And he's been good enough to say, yes, he would spend some more time with us this morning. And let me give you a little bit more background on him. He is an author, a journalist, a foreign policy analyst. He has written articles that have appeared in many, many magazines and papers. And just to mention a few, The Nation, The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Christian Science Monitor. He has authored 5 books that deal with American politics, American history, and also with the Middle East. That book is A Fire in Zion, The Israeli-Palestinian Search for Peace. That was published in 1994. And more recently, he's been writing on issues like American history around the period of the Civil War, civil rights, and so forth. He's been a journalist. He's served as editor and Washington bureau chief for a number of publications, was editor-publisher of Washington, D.C.'s City Paper. He was editor of The Veteran. He served as a special correspondent for The Nation, was editor of Middle East Insight. He's also involved with the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. That's an international humanitarian group, and in that position, he was involved in coordinating the work of the international campaign to ban landmines, for which they founded and which won the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can get in as many different people as possible and keep things moving along. But anybody's welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people want to call, they are welcome. Mr. Perry, hello.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time very much.
No problem.
This is, I know, a very difficult question because a lot has happened over the last now something like 16 months of this, what has been called the Second Intifada. But I guess I find myself going back, thinking back to a story that I read that came, it was published in, it was in the New York Times in 2000, and I don't recall whether this was, say, early September or late August, but it was just shortly before Ariel Sharon made his ill-fated visit to the Temple Mount. And there was a story about the fact that Yasser Arafat had gone to dinner at the house of the former Israeli prime minister.
Yes.
And the fact that before the current government, and about the fact that they had gotten together and that they had had the best meeting that they ever had. It was a story that was just glowing with optimism. And this was Ehud Barak.
That's correct.
And that they had this fabulous meeting, and that it was a matter of days. It may have been a week, a few days, when suddenly the whole thing fell apart. And one wonders, assuming that story about the, you know, this wonderful dinner that the two men had was the way that it was. What happened? Were things, in fact, so, was the balance so fragile that somehow in a matter of days it seemed that in a matter of days the entire peace process just completely fell apart? What happened?
It's really interesting that you would focus on that dinner. Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat had just finished a series of negotiations in which they had come very close to an agreement. Now, nothing was agreed to. The offer was on the table. It was a good offer, but it wasn't the offer that Arafat wanted. But they agreed to work on the offer, and we were, let's say, 3 days away from a final resolution of the problem. And you're absolutely right. After that dinner, everything did fall apart. At that dinner, you should know, Ehud Barak mentioned to Yasser Arafat that Ariel Sharon was seeking a permission to march on the Temple Mount. And both Arafat and, well, Clinton wasn't at the dinner, but later Clinton also pleaded with Barack not to allow the march. He thought it would be incendiary and inflammatory and would lead to violence. And Arafat was very blunt. He didn't know whether he could control that kind of violence, and the march was coming at a particularly bad time. Barack later told Arafat that he controlled Sharon, not to worry, it was just a little march. I was in the West Bank in Israel at the time, the night before the march, and it was already clear that things were falling apart, that the fact that Barack let the march go forward was going to lead to violence. The march occurred the day I left, and the day after that, six Palestinians were shot in Jerusalem, and we had a spiral of violence that no one was able to control, not the Israelis nor the Palestinians. And here we are, 14 months later, and it has been an ongoing tragedy, and we are now worse off 14 months later than we have been at any point, I think, in the last 10 years in this peace process. Hmm.
Well, it's certainly one of the things that I guess that it would suggest is that it takes fewer people to make war than it does to make peace. And here we had the two men, Barak and Arafat, and that for them it seems that they, both of them, had to deal with people who were hardliners on both sides, that they really either had to try to placate or at least try to keep under some kind of rein. And what it turns out that neither of them could.
I think that's right. And we've been focusing most recently on Arafat's inability to do so, but it's not surprising that he's unable to do so. It's difficult to rein in radicals in a situation where your people are under occupation and economic conditions are deplorable, worse now than at any time, and settlements keep expanding. And it's difficult also for the Israeli side, because no one can defend or justify car bombs in Jerusalem. On the other hand, the continued occupation of the Palestinian territories and even an offensive against Hamas and Islamic Jihad just doesn't seem to be working, and it's certainly not a long-term solution. So we're almost in what I call a political lockdown. Neither side is able to move very easily. I think that there is a silver lining in the clouds. Things seem to have calmed a little bit. Arafat has been slowly but surely attempting to regain control of the moderates. He has made significant arrests, as have the Israelis. So perhaps here in a week or two we'll be in a situation where we could return to the peace table and pick up where we left off 14 months ago.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the pessimists would say that would point to the fact that now through all of this, it seems that at least when you talk to the official spokespersons of both sides, the first thing they always say was, "Well, it's the other guy. If the other side would just stop what they're doing, then we could go forward." And it seems to be there seems to be, at least in my mind, some question as to whether in the past on both sides they have made commitments that they didn't really intend to keep, and that for in both cases there are cherished sort of ideas that they are holding on to that are counterproductive, that can't be made to work. And at the, you know, and on the one hand, maybe the idea that violence can somehow we can somehow sweep Israel off into the sea and get rid of them on the one hand, or the other hand, that somehow that Israel can continue to expand and get, and we can continue to build settlements, and we don't really have to deal with the claim of the Palestinians to actually have a homeland. It seems somehow on both sides there are people who said they were committed to dealing with those, but in their hearts, you wonder, did they really mean it?
I think it's a hallmark of the relationship. It's actually a pretty good observation, because it does seem to be a hallmark of the relationship that when you get a Palestinian and Israeli in the same room, and I've been privy to a lot of these conversations, they spend the first 20 minutes pointing the finger at each other, trying to figure out whose grandmother started this mess. And that gets nowhere. And that's where we are now. We're in a shouting match. And what we need to do is to get past that. I think the situation we've been in is that the politics of the center in both Israeli and Palestinian society has been very undynamic. They haven't moved very quickly, neither of the center parties and neither of the moderate parties. And so they've allowed themselves to be pushed by the extremists on both sides. And it's happened in Israeli history where you had a guy like Baruch Goldstein go into a mosque and shoot 27 Palestinians dead. And what I think the only way to, the way that we got out of that situation was Rabin, who was the, Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister at the time, called Arafat and said, listen, I'll control my radicals, you control yours. I'll support you in your control of your radicals, you please support me in my control of my radicals, and we'll work together as a team to try to get the peace process going. And that worked. It worked for quite a while. It worked for 5 years, and there was steady and certain progress towards a political solution. Ariel Sharon has rejected that way of doing things, and Arafat has reciprocated. And we are now in a situation where we have a lot of, you know, name-calling, whose grandmother started this thing, and a lot of each of the societies looking over their shoulder trying to determine what the radicals are going to do next. To break out of that is going to take a kind of a partnership between Sharon and Arafat that doesn't seem likely to happen.
Well, that's that was, you know, when it would be one of my next questions. Given what Mr. Sharon has said about Mr. Arafat, said he was quote-unquote irrelevant, made it sound as if there's no way that he's ever going to sit down and talk to him. Now, others, European governments and other people have said, as far as we're concerned, that Arafat is still the person that the majority of the Palestinians think is their leader and their representative. As long as they feel that way, we're going to continue to say, well, all right, he is the representative of the Palestinians. But if the government of if the prime minister of Israel says, I'm not going to have anything to do with this guy, then where do you go from there?
Well, it's shocking to me that Sharon said that. There doesn't seem to be any message discipline, I guess is the term we use in Washington. There doesn't seem to be any message discipline coming out of the Israeli government. Sharon said he was irrelevant, and you had a lot of head-scratching in Washington because Arafat is the, we might not like Arafat, but he is the elected leader of the Palestinian people overwhelmingly. There is a big consensus behind him. He has a lot of stature in this. He's been around a long time. He's very well respected in the Arab world, even admired. And other Israeli prime ministers have known that if you want to have peace with the Palestinians, you can pick up the phone and call Arafat, and he's the only guy to call. On the other hand, we also know that Sharon is, to the Palestinians, an absolutely repugnant individual. They hold him responsible for the deaths of Palestinians in the refugee camps in Lebanon in the early 1980s. They don't want to have anything to do with them, and yet they know, too. If you really want to have peace with Israel, you have to deal with their elected leadership, and after all, Ariel Sharon is the elected prime minister of a democratic state that they border and with people that they live with every day. So what we have to do is stop talking about who's going to replace who and understand Sharon is there for better or worse, and so is Arafat.
Our guest this morning is Mark Perry. He is a journalist, an author, a foreign policy analyst. He has written a lot about American politics and history, but also about the Middle East. And we're talking here this morning about where things stand right at the moment in the conflict involving Israel and Palestinians and the possibility that sometime soon things get back on track to talking about peace. We have several callers getting lined up here, and of course the opinions, questions, comments of people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll start with Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello?
I have two questions about how Arafat is irrelevant. First question, since Arafat has violated virtually every agreement that he's ever made, what point is there in making agreements with him? He's irrelevant. Second question, since it's the radicals who are causing the problem, and Arafat can't control his radicals, what point is there in negotiating with him? He's irrelevant.
Well, Mr. Perry, what do you think?
Well, the Israelis can't control their radicals either. And there is a strong...
They had one radical.
Well... There are radicals in Israeli society. The settlers are armed, and they're dangerous, and they shoot Palestinians, and it happens.
How many times do you have to have mass murders before somebody on his own initiative, is going to start shooting back?
Well, you had mass murder in Beirut in 1984. You've had a mass murder in Hebron 5 years ago. You've had mass murders of Palestinians done at the hands of Israelis. There are, believe me, radicals on both sides. The question is, can they get them under control? Well, we might say that Arafat is irrelevant, and Sharon might say Arafat is irrelevant, but last night Ariel Sharon sent his top aides to a security meeting with top aides for Yasser Arafat. He's not irrelevant. He's not going to be irrelevant. If you want to deal with the Palestinian people, you have to deal with Palestinian politics. And the head of the political establishment in Palestine is Arafat. You don't have to like Arafat, but the political reality is, who else are you going to deal with? You can either deal with him or you can deal with Hamas. And I don't think that the Israelis want to deal with Hamas. They've made it very clear they're not going to.
Well, you could deal with him the way that Jordan dealt with him. Jordan kicked him out.
Well, if you kick Arafat out of, if the Israelis go after Arafat and kick him out of the West Bank right now, you're going to have a bloodbath. Nobody wants that. You had an Israeli member of the Knesset in the New York Times this morning pleading with the Bush administration not to give Sharon a green light, because the last time that any administration gave Sharon a green light, it was in Beirut. There were 1,000 Israeli soldiers killed in a disaster for the next 20 years for Israel on its northern border. There has to be a way to rein in both sides, both Arafat and, in this case, Sharon, I would argue. And if we can get them back on track and back to the peace table, we're going to have a chance of resolving this problem. If you kill Arafat or you kick the Palestinians out, if you expel the Palestinians, and the Israeli government has been talking about that, very incendiary, you can have a general war in the Middle East. We shouldn't allow our friendship with Israel to blind us to the political realities of the Middle East. If you walk in the Middle East and you talk to anybody who's an Arab in any country and ask them what the major problem in the region is, they'll say Palestinian statehood. They don't have to be right. You don't have to like it, but that's what they say.
Well, just ask me one final question. Why was it all right for Jordan to kick the Palestinians out of Jordan? I mean, here's an Arab country. The Palestinians are Arabs. Mm-hmm. Why was it proper and right, and nobody complained when Jordan kicked the Palestinians out of Jordan, but the Israelis can't kick the Palestinians out of Israel?
Well, they're not in Israel. They're in the West Bank and Gaza.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And that's not Israel. And we shouldn't pretend that it is Israel. There are 1 million Palestinians in Israel, and they're Israeli citizens, and they're good Israeli citizens, and they live in a democratic country, and they have members of the Knesset. But the West Bank and Gaza isn't Israel. The West Bank and Gaza is 95% Palestinian, the other 5% being Israeli settlers who are radical. And what we're talking about when we talk about kicking the Palestinians out is kicking them off their land, the West Bank and Gaza, which they have right now.
I want to get on some other callers. So the lines are all full here, and we're getting almost close to the midpoint. I just wanted, though, touch on, it's just something that you mentioned that we really didn't talk about in the first, 10, 15 minutes we were chatting. And that is that while it is true on the one hand that Ariel Sharon said that Mr. Arafat was irrelevant and made it sound like he wouldn't have anything to do with him. Indeed, as you say, though, that senior Israeli and Palestinian officers have been meeting to talk about what's going on. So it makes it sound like Sharon really wants to have it both ways. He wants to be able to make his public condemnation of Arafat to satisfy the people who want to hear that. And yet at the same time, even he has to know that there's, maybe he's not going to sit down across the table from Yasser Arafat, but he's got to know that as you say, that there is nobody else to talk to.
Well, his primary concern, that's right. I think you're right. His primary concern, as it is for every head of state, is the security of his nation and his people. And he knows Arafat can get not all of the radicals under control, but a lot of them, and Arafat has been working hard over the last 4 days to do that. You haven't heard too many complaints about Israel saying he hasn't. And so now Sharon has gone back to the Palestinian Authority and said, all right, you've taken some first steps. What about this? Can't you do this? Or can't you do this? Or how about this guy? And the Palestinians have said, listen, we could do this, but you need to do some things too. Like you could ease the closure of Ramallah so our police can move. Hmm. And so it's that kind of discussion that's going on, and it does involve the Palestinian leadership.
And I guess maybe one other quick point, and I have been as guilty of this as anybody else, that we do talk about the Palestinians as if they were this this monolithic kind of group, and obviously not all Palestinians are strapping bombs to themselves and going and blowing themselves up. But then that gets back to the question that you raised earlier. If there are within the Palestinian movement, if there are people who are interested in taking a more moderate approach, then where are they? How did they get involved in the process and get to the point where at least they have an equal voice, if not a greater voice, than those people who are saying the only way here is to use violence?
I think that we have a lot of stereotypes about Palestinian society, and I think the stereotypes perhaps are the natural result of fear. This is a very secular society. They have a strong tradition of democracy. 20% of Palestinians are Christians. Most of the Muslims, the vast majority of the Muslims, could care less about Hamas or Islamic Jihad. And we have had a lot of moderates rise up in the Palestinian political establishment. 3 months ago, Mr. Arafat appointed a man by the name of Sari Nusebi as head of the Jerusalem Bureau for the Palestinian Authority. Sari Nusebi is American-educated, Ph.D., head of a very distinguished family, and a very, very moderate person who has said publicly he doesn't believe in the right of return, and the Palestinians need to give up the idea of the right of return, which is a total criticism of Arafat. The other day, Sari Nusebi had a reception for Israelis and Palestinians in Jerusalem. And right before the reception, he was arrested by the Israeli forces, and the comment from an Israeli minister said, well, having a reception in Jerusalem among Palestinians is an act of terrorism. And everyone laughed out loud about it, and they released Sari Nusebi in a very embarrassing posture and apologized to him. But we have this kind of thing going on where even Palestinian moderates are targeted as potential terrorists by Israel, albeit by an Israel that is very frightened and very concerned about its security. So this is a mess, and it's going to take a long time for each side to unwrap it. But the kind of incendiary and inflammatory statements we've seen from both sides over the last 4 weeks at least have got to end, and I think maybe they will over the next week or two.
We have several other callers. Next in line is Oakwood, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes, I wondered, what are the chances that the Israeli government could be could change to a more moderate government, or is that Sharon sort of in there for the long foreseeable future?
Whistling in the wind, I'm afraid. I think that what we've seen over the last year, not just in Palestinian society, as I mentioned, a move towards a more radical posture, but also in Israel, is the evaporation of the left and the peace movement in Israel. It's almost non-existent now. I think the evaporation of the left and the peace movement in Israel came as a result of the car bombings, which is interesting because it clearly shows that the strategy of Hamas and Islamic Jihad is not to target Israelis, although they do that. They kill Israelis. They have no hopes of defeating Israel. Their target, the reason they set off these car bombs, is to undermine and attack the peace process. They don't want an agreement with Israel. And the Palestinian Authority and moderate Israelis want a peace agreement. I think that at least for the foreseeable future, we're going to have a government of Ariel Sharon in place and in office, I would say, for at least 2 years.
Does Hamas really think they can get rid of Israel? I mean, do they?
No. They think that they can get rid of the peace process. They think they can enhance their political standing in the Palestinian territories. These are not. This is going to sound a little controversial. Hamas is not crazy. They're not led by crazy people. They're led by very intelligent, often Western-educated, absolutely dedicated political animals who seek political power, and they seek political power within Palestinian society. And they would love to be able to run a Republic of Palestine, and they think that the way they can do that is to target the peace process, which undermines Arafat and gives them strength inside their own society. They're not going to be able to throw the Israelis into the sea. They know that. They don't have a prayer. This is like spitwads versus tanks. It's not even a contest. So why are they doing it? The Israelis know they don't have a prayer of this. They're doing it to gain political power inside of Palestinian society. And every time that Israel rockets Arafat's headquarters and destroys the Palestinian Authority's police, who are supposed to go out and get Hamas, the Israelis actually help Hamas, and Hamas gains strength. That kind of policy has got to stop.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's we'll go back here to the telephones, and next caller up is in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
I think that, you know, your last point was very much on target. And my feeling is that, in fact, Sharon and those people he's most closely aligned with have no interest in any kind of peace deal and are just using the, any rhetoric towards that that they can to, further their own agenda, which I think is, they would really like to do is annex the West Bank and drive the Palestinians out. And I think until the United States stops, really favoring the Israeli government and not in any way I see, acting as an even-handed negotiator and broker, and start putting some pressure on Sharon and the Israeli government, there's not going to be any real move to peace.
Well, I haven't agreed with that, and you don't hear many Americans actually saying that. I think that Sharon is dangerous, and I'm not the only one saying this. I'm quoting Israeli officials who not only oppose him politically, but are just heartbroken that he's prime minister and are very afraid that he's going to wield military power and go over the line in wielding military power and plunge the region into a war that would be disastrous for Israel. They'd win the war, but it would be disastrous for them. And they don't want that to happen. I'm not a fan of Sharon, but he is the prime minister of Israel. I think that he must realize, I hope that he does, I think that he must realize there is no way that Israel could annex the West Bank. Just the sheer demographics of the situation, no matter, you could maybe kick out 1 million Palestinians, but another 1 million would remain, who would become part of Israel as citizens of Israel, let's say, eventually. The demographics would work against him, and they are working against him. Israel could, if he does that, Israel could disappear as a Jewish majority nation, and taking over the West Bank would present him with almost insurmountable military obstacles. Very difficult. The war would go on for a long time. A lot of people would die. Israel would lose its standing internationally, and probably also with the United States. So I don't think he's going to do it. But I think that he will try to force out as many Palestinians as he can, and he will try to undermine Arafat and gain a halfway military solution, a halfway political solution at some point down the road.
Do you think he has some kind of vision of an end game in mind, or is he just, sort of haphazardly, well, maybe that's not the right term, but I guess, it's kind of hard to understand, given that reality, what he thinks he can actually accomplish. That going down the road he's going down.
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I would, and I've often wondered whether Mr. Sharon has a strategy. I think if he does have a strategy, it's something like, I guess we could call it a pacification campaign, where the Israelis would control the countryside, would continue to build settlements that would surround Palestinian towns, and that the Palestinians would live in five or six cities, Ramallah, Jenin, Tulkarm, Bethlehem, Jericho, and that the rest of the Palestinians would be plunged into a poverty from which they couldn't recover, so they would become the urban poor of these cities. But Israel would use the West Bank as a kind of a buffer, and as the Palestinians say, their cities would be Bantustans. There would be a clear policy of kind of a proto-apartheid. I think if he has a strategy, that's it. I do not believe that he has a strategy as Ehud Barak did, which was a full resolution piece of the peace process where the Palestinians get 97% to 98% of their land back. The Israelis end occupation, but with clear security guarantees, and perhaps even an international force for a period of time on the ground. And I think that that is the way to go. I think that that's possible. I think there are voices and powers in both society that can make that possible, but I don't think that's Sharon's vision.
Well, I think the only way you're going to get that is if we really threaten to cut off all funding and put some real political pressure on, and I'm afraid there's probably not a political majority for that. Well, thanks.
All right, thanks. Well, there you get to, again, one of the questions that I wanted to raise is that in what way could outside intervention by the United States or United Nations move things along? And would it indeed take someone to come in and say, as I've read some editorials say, to say to both parties, now look, this is the way that it's going to be. You're going to have to forget some of the things that you've held on to for so long if you want peace, and that we're going to do all the, you know, we're going to guarantee on both sides, we're going to guarantee security, we're going to guarantee statehood for the Palestinians, but the Palestinians are going to have to forget right of return, and the Israelis are going to have to move those people out of those settlements and find someplace else for them to live, and we are going to put peacekeepers in between the two sides for as long as it takes before you give up the idea of killing each other. And at the same time, I think everybody says in the real world, it seems pretty unlikely that that would ever happen. Is that indeed what it would take? And is there any chance that it would ever happen?
I think that there is a chance for an imposed solution by the United States where a Secretary of State, let's say Colin Powell, gets on a plane, takes a map, lays it out with Arafat and Sharon or whoever, and says, here's the line. And these settlements got to go, and we're going to do this, or both sides are going to suffer, but here are the inducements for doing it. Here's the pot of money. To keep your countries economically viable till they can support themselves. I think that I would be for us taking a very clear stance and attempting to do that, but we should understand what that would take. Imposing a political solution in the Middle East means imposing it on the Israelis, and because they would have to give up the land. They would have to end the occupation. Mm-hmm. So imposing a political solution is imposing it on Israel. And to do that takes enormous political will from any president of the United States, and it will come at enormous political cost in the United States. And so far, at least, there has not been a president willing to walk down that path. And I wonder if, I doubt that this president would be willing to do that.
And I suppose that some people also would raise the issue of even if you could argue that in the long run this would be good for everyone, that there would be some people who would say, see, you know, there the United States is doing it again.
Yeah.
You know, there's the United States coming in and saying, here, you know, imposing some kind of a solution, saying, okay, this is the way we think that this should be. And that, you know, one, I would even wonder whether in the Arab world whether that would fly.
Well, there is this accusation towards the United States of our arrogance. Mm-hmm. And that is one reason that we've hesitated in the past to put any pressure on anybody, Palestinians or Israelis, and we're still accused of being arrogant. I think honestly that we might get to the point where the downside of not having an imposed solution would outweigh the downside of having one. In fact, if we are going to continue our war on terrorism, and we need to recruit moderate Arab countries to really stand behind us and weather the problems that they're going to have in their own societies by standing behind us, then the price of doing that might well be from Egypt, Jordan, Syria, solve the Palestinian-Israeli problem now. And when you have Iraq out there with possibly weapons of mass destruction, and you have a teetering Saudi regime that everyone's questioning, the downside of doing nothing might far... is not what you want, and so you take your lumps by imposing a solution. You're called arrogant. People here in the United States protest. The American Jewish community is up in arms about how could we do this to Israel, and Israel would do that too. But Israel might say publicly, "This is outrageous that you would impose a solution on us," and privately say, "Thank you. At least now we understand where we are." So this is a very complex problem, and there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but. Like I say, it takes incredible political will.
I want to get back to the phones here because I have several callers, but also real quick, again, introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Mark Perry. He is a journalist, foreign policy analyst. His articles have appeared in many publications, including the LA Times and Christian Science Monitor and the Washington Post. He has been a special correspondent for The Nation, editor of Middle East Insight, interviewed widely in CNN and other places. He's authored a number of books, and I want to mention just one because it bears directly on this subject that we're talking about. That is A Fire in Zion, the Israeli-Palestinian Search for Peace, that was published in 1994. I have a number of callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Going next to Belgium, Illinois, line 3. Hello.
Yes. To echo a bit of the previous caller's sentiments and points of view, we seem to have caused our own problem there, and we are very much a center of that problem, in that even the aspect in September stems greatly from this Middle East policy we have of not being equitable on both sides of the problem. When a Palestinian sees an American-produced helicopter that's putting rockets into their streets, is obviously going to cause a problem for us. When we allow a gentleman like Sharon, who is very nearly a war criminal with his actions in Lebanon several years ago, to become prime minister, there's another problem. And it goes on and on. We don't report equally on the topic in every direction. How can we possibly ever expect the problem to be solved in any way if we're not fair on both sides of the problem? Sharon aggravated the problem. He purposely went to the Temple Mount just to cause the problem because he wants to be in just as you mentioned, be in political control. And it just precipitates itself on and on and on. Why can't we just either step completely back from the problem and let them totally fight the problem out themselves, which unfortunately the Palestinians would lose because this is an asymmetric war. That's why you see young men putting 20 pounds of dynamite on their body and going into a Tel Aviv marketplace. It's just very obvious that this is the only way for them to solve the problem, when it'd be very, very easy for us to solve the problem just by saying, okay, today we are no longer going to have one side or the other. It's just a plain, simple, down the center. We're going to be even on both sides.
I think down the center is exactly right, but let me give a different perspective. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East when I was there last. I was in downtown Tel Aviv, and not many Americans, I don't think, have been in downtown Tel Aviv, unless you're a Jewish American, but I have, and I love Tel Aviv. It's an amazing city with a Hebrew culture, the most distinctive Hebrew culture of any city in the world. And I go into bars and discotheques just to kind of get a feel for whether the society is modern and how Hebrew it really is, and whether it's Orthodox or Reform, or, you know, it's an interesting study. And what I find are young people, 17, 18, 19, 20 to 25-year-olds who've been born in Israel, live in Israel, grown up in Israel, they're going to make their life in Israel. It's the only country they know. This isn't their fault. And they don't deserve to be targeted by Palestinian terrorist bombers. And it has to be stopped. And we can go down the middle, but we have to understand, here's a country that if we don't support it, nobody else will. An American diplomat said the other day, well, we don't want Israel to be isolated. Well, we're isolated with Israel, but they don't have many friends in the world, and this is a society worth saving and nurturing and defending. I agree with going down the middle. I think that is the solution. But there's a lot of sentiment here in the United States for Israel. We've helped Israel a lot, and they've helped us a lot. So it's going to be hard to overcome our natural ties to that country and walk down the middle of the line. I agree that we ought to, but that's going to be hard to do.
We have someone obviously listening on the internet in San Francisco. We'll go there next, line four. Hello.
Hi. I was pretty interested in this issue. A number of years ago, I read a book called The Last Mafioso. It's by Louis Fracciano, and he describes back in the 40s that when the state of Israel was being developed, David Ben-Gurion and whatnot, Menachem Begin came into the United States. He was trying to do a fundraising tour that Albert Einstein opposed with very vociferously, because although Einstein was a Zionist, he very much disagreed with Begin, believing him to be organized crime and a terrorist. And it was stated in this Last Mafioso book that when Begin came in, he was doing this fundraising tour. He got in touch with Meyer Lansky and a number of other prominent Jewish organized crime figures, and they did a quid pro quo that if organized crime made donations to the emerging state of Israel, then they would get control of the military. Well, if we look at the huge funding that goes to Israel, very little of it is going toward peace, and a huge amount is going toward the military. So is this money going to organized crime? And to your earlier statement just a couple of seconds ago, you had said that no one else in the world is interested in supporting Israel. Is this the reason why? Is organized crime in control of Israel, and is that part of the foreign policy reason why we're not getting any justice out of it.
Well, I got to admit that's a new one on me. Mr. Perry, you got any comment on it?
I've heard this story. My simple answer to the question is organized crime in charge of Israel is no. The Zionists are in charge of Israel. It's a political, secular movement within Judaism, very strong in Europe at the end of World War II. Its program was to bring Jews to Palestine and settle Palestine. The program began in the 1890s and continued until there was a Jewish majority. The Zionists were extremely well organized. It was a very well thought through political program, but it had divisions in it, just like the Palestinian National Movement does. And one of the divisions occurred between David Ben-Gurion and Menachem Begin. And Ben-Gurion, and one famous incident in the Knesset after the founding of Israel, called Begin a fascist and a Nazi, and Begin almost strode across the hall and hit him. So this is a very volatile political movement. Begin, so far as I know, was not involved in organized crime. And there's probably organized crime in Israel, but there's organized crime in every country. There is in the Palestinian Authority, too. And we don't give money to Israel because of organized crime. We give money to Israel because they're a strategic partner of ours. And that's my simple answer to an interesting story, but a story that I think in this particular book, and I'm familiar with it, is filled with half-truths.
All right, let's talk with the next person in Munster, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Yes. I wanted to ask, wasn't there a request by the Palestinian Authority to have monitors from the UN in the Gaza Strip? And didn't they take a vote on that, and the United States and Israel voted it down? I was just wondering, why would they vote something like that down? Wouldn't they want a clear picture of what was actually happening there? And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
There was a vote last week in the Security Council, not the General Assembly, but the Security Council, and the United Nations vetoed a Palestinian request that international monitors be on the ground. And the reason that we vetoed it is Ambassador to the UN, John Negroponte, said we did not want to isolate Israel in the world community. Of course, being the only country to vote against the resolution, we did isolate them, but that's always been our policy. I think the reason that Israel does not want UN monitors on the ground is because they simply don't trust the UN. The UN has a history of being very anti-Israeli. There was a UN resolution that was up for discussion for many years, calling Zionism racism, and Israel is very, very, because of that, I think, very mistrustful of the United Nations. If there were to be some other international peace force that would include American elements as a part of a political deal, I don't think that Israel would oppose that, so long as it wasn't the United Nations. So the caller's right, there was a resolution, and it was vetoed by the United States.
We have a couple of minutes left. We'll try to get at least one more caller. We'll go to Champagne here, line four. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask about what you started the discussion with, which was the period just before Sharon went up to the Temple Mount, when supposedly there was this Barak and Arafat almost had a deal. And my understanding is, and you could correct me, is that Arafat refused to take it, even though it was the best deal supposedly he had ever had in terms of getting most of the land of the West Bank and various other things, even some part of Jerusalem.
The correct word that you use is supposedly. Because
I can only say supposedly.
Yeah, I understand. This is a story that has been particularly difficult for people who have been following this conflict to get around. We keep hearing that Arafat got the best deal he could have ever had at Camp David. In fact, there was no deal at Camp David. There was nothing that was close to, there was nothing that was even close to what he had, what he could have taken back legitimately to the Palestinian people as a peace deal. A week later, this best deal ever offered to Arafat got better. Barak came back and said, okay, we understand there are reasons why you couldn't accept that deal. What about this one? Arafat went back, talked with his people, and said, you know what? It's almost there, but not quite. I cannot do this for this reason, this reason, this reason. They came back a week later. Israel even gave him a better deal. There were three. What remained were words, paragraphs that had to be worked on.
That was it. They were 3 days, I think. They were about 3 days away from a final deal that would have been acceptable to both sides. That is to say, it would have protected Israel's security and given the Palestinians their state when Sharon marched on the Temple Mount. So they were almost there, but not quite. And it wasn't the deal of the century. It was good, but it wasn't something that Arafat would have taken back to his people. Let me just mention one quote, and I know we're running out of time. Clinton upbraided Arafat and said, well, Sadat would have signed this deal. Sadat signed a deal with Israel, and Arafat said, Sadat was assassinated. That was Arafat's answer. He said, if I'm going to take a deal back to my people, I've got to be able to stand up in front of them without fear of being shot and tell them, this is the best we can do, and it's good for us. He said, and we're not there yet. And that's how it went down. Unfortunately and tragically, I wish it had gone the other way.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I think that we're pretty much at the point that we're going to have to stop.
Let me, if I might, just interrupt you and mention
yes.
that I have a recent book out. It's called Lift Up Thy Voice. I did want to get it in, and it's a shameless way to do it, but it's a good history of an American family. Lift Up Thy Voice. It's available in any bookstore. It just came out a year ago, or at Amazon.com.
And this is the book. It's about, at least in part, it's about the Civil War, or America at the time of the Civil War.
America at the time of the Civil War is a history of the family that was a white family and became a black family. Who were slaveholders, then abolitionists, and then civil rights leaders. I think it's a fascinating read, and I hope that your listeners are interested in it.
All right, so you can look for that in the bookstore. Mr. Perry, I want to say thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest this morning, Mark